Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves. And I'm joined today by a very, very special guest, the Honorable Mr. David Merriam. And we are going to talk about Bull Terriers. And there's an awful lot of knowledge here. So I hope you guys are ready for some listening. So thank you for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So what started you in your quest to have the perfect Bull Terrier?
Well, when I was 14... a friend gave me a white Bull Terrier bitch. Her name was Gigi. And within a year, when she was like 11 months old, she won a specialty.
Oh my gosh.
So the hook was fully inserted at that
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. And what year was this, dare I ask?
This was in 1953. So I've been in the breed, 65 years or so. And it's been a really rewarding avocation. And it's good to get away from your vocation and to get into something that you enjoy. And it's been an exciting and a pleasing thing, both with the Bull Terriers and with the American Kennel Club activity.
Absolutely. And you are an American Kennel Club judge of dogs, but you were also clearly a regulation judge.
Yes, I was a trial court judge in Southern California for 20 years.
So this seems like a break.
Well, there's a similarity between judging law cases and judging dog shows.
Excellent. Tell us about that.
Well, the similarity is that each has a standard. American Kennel Club has a standard for each breed, and in the courts, the standard is known as the law. And in the courts, you receive evidence, whether it be testimony or physical evidence. And in a dog show, the evidence is the dogs in front of you, and what you see and feel, and the application of the standard to those animals.
I love that.
My fellow judges never appreciated that analogy. The difference, of course, is that in dog show judging, it's comparative. In the law courts, it's either a verdict for one or the other, or guilty or innocence. So it's not comparative there.
But well, and we rarely go to jail in the dog show.
No, that's right.
So talk to us a little bit about why the Bull Terrier captured you as a breed. Some of the hallmarks of the breed that really made it special for you.
Oh, I don't think it was nearly that sophisticated. Prior to my having been given this Bull Terrier, I had some collies. And I did a little obedience with them, and they were not very good collies, conformation-wise. But I showed them a little bit when I was just an early teenager. Then I was given this Bull Terrier, which won quite a bit. And winning is better than losing. And it isn't a natural transition aesthetically from collies to Bull Terriers.
The one piece head? I don't know.
Yeah. So that's probably the basis. And then, right, of course, they grow on you.
Yes.
And you get chauvinistic about them, and you think they have unique and peculiar characteristics that other breeds don't have. And you just grow into them.
So let's talk about Bull Terriers specifically. Let's talk about the head. Let's talk about some of the, you say not myths, but maybe misunderstandings about the breed that you encounter as a judge, as a breeder. Some of those things that you want people to think about when they're looking at their breeding program,
well,
or their weight.
I think the listeners should realize that I haven't been judging for about 4 or 5 years now, and I haven't been breeding for longer than that.
Okay.
But the essence of the Bull Terrier is the head.
Yes.
I mean, it's one of those breeds that we refer to as a head breed. And it's got a reasonably good standard describing the head. It's an egg-shaped head. We think of a chicken egg, not an ostrich head. Egg. And that has really only come to be here in the States to be commonly found in the last 20 years or so.
Really?
I mean, yeah, the heads have improved enormously in the last 20 years. So that you have a very gentle curve in the profile, and you want a small, dark, deep-set triangular eye, and you'd want a lot of fill in front of the eye.
Right.
So that, as Alva Rosenberg described one time, you close your eyes and you put your hand on the head, and it should be like a velvet egg. And That's probably as good a description. The breed has fought a continual problem on mouths because yes. of the shape of the top of the head. And when you have a very strong underjaw, which you want a deep underjaw, there's a tendency for it to go undershot. And realizing, of course, that its ancestors were the old bull and terrier. And it's interesting, you can sit at the English bulldog ring and you will see every fault that you can imagine in a bull terrier.
That's correct for a bulldog.
Yes, but they come from right. basically the same stock in the wow. early 1800s.
So historically, the bull terrier had the job of...
Well, that's part of the myth, and that it was thought because in the early Victorian days, there were the blood sports, bull baiting and the bear baiting and dog fighting and what have you. It was really thought at one time that the bull terrier was developed by about 1840 by a man named James Hinks. At least he was the primary developer. But the research that's been done by Dr. David Harris, who wrote the seminal bull terrier breed book, indicates that the bull terrier, and particularly what became the white bull terrier, became more of a gentleman's dog than a pit fighting dog. So there really isn't that history of it, although they're related to the Amstaffs and mm-hmm. the pit bulls and what have you. But as we note, there's a huge difference in head between those breeds.
So you just made a comment that I thought was very interesting. My understanding is the white bull terrier and the colored bull terrier are essentially the same standard, or are the same standard,
yes, they
differentiated,
are.
Okay, only by color. So did you see historically a difference in development between the colored bull terrier and the white bull terrier in terms of what they did?
It developed as the white bull terrier.
Okay.
And those that were devoted to the white bull terrier thought the colored bull terriers were mongrels. It wasn't until the late 1930s that the colored bull terrier was imported into the States from England. They had accepted them a little bit earlier, but begrudgingly so. And there was a huge fight within the bull terrier fraternity as to what they're going to do with the coloreds, because people like Billy Kendrick, who was scion of the bull terriers in the Philadelphia area, said, we simply can't allow these mongrels to come in and destroy the white bull terrier. So there was a fight with the American Kennel Club, and the bull terrier said, no, we won't have them. And the American Kennel Club said, well, you will have them or you won't be part of the American Kennel Club. So they begrudgingly accepted them in. And their development was slow. I mean, from 38 on, and it wasn't up until the 70s or so that the quality colors began to be developed.
Okay, that's very interesting. And now you think they're pretty comparable, colored to white?
Yeah, they are, because there's a great deal of interbreeding mm-hmm. between them. And I must say it's been a successful marriage, because some problems that have been associated with white bull terriers over the years have been deafness, because related to lack of pigmentation, mm-hmm. and also some skin problems, and deafness, because they bred white to white to white to white to white. But when the bear tests began to become available, the Dalmatians introduced it mm-hmm. first, and the mm-hmm. bull terriers seized it very soon thereafter. Mm. And it was an interesting story in that they started bear testing bull terriers and developed some statistics. And they found that if you breed white to white, there was about a third of your litter was like to have some carrying deficiency, either bilateral or unilateral. If, however, you bred white to colored, that went down to about 6%. And if you bred colored to colored, you hardly ever got any hearing problems. So Bull Terrier Club of America, without imposing any sanctions or any force, presented this to the breeders. And breeders who had for years swore they would never have a colored bull terrier about found the value in it. And on their own volition, they started doing the crossing, so that today, relatively little deafness
wow.
in white. And there's some, but relatively little. So it was an example of where if you give competent breeders the tools and the information, they'll help correct the situation, and you don't put out regulations or enforcement saying, if this dog is deaf, it's going to be excommunicated.
That's actually fabulous, and I know there's a lot of breeds that deal with this type of thing, whether it's a health question or a color
yes,
question
yes.
or what have you. So that's really good knowledge. So today, when you have a litter of bull terriers, you're going to have some colored and some white. Is that pretty much a... Well, and you just register them as they come out, or...
If the sire is white and the dam is white, you'll only get white.
Okay.
You cannot get colored. If you breed colored to a white, you'll get both. And, of course, we've got a variety of colors, starting with the brindle and the reds and the smuts and the tricolors and the black brindles and what have you. So the genetics of color breeding is slightly beyond me, but it's known, I guess.
I'm always curious, you know, like beagles, they start out 13-inch, suddenly they're 15-inch. Yeah. How do you register that, you know?
So when coloreds came in, they were accepted by the American Kennel Club. They were in their phase then of developing varieties.
Right.
Either in size or in coat and what have you. And so in bull terriers, they brought coloreds in as a variety. There was a white variety and then the colored variety. They could be interbred because they were within one breed. But it developed into the situation that the United States and the American Kennel Club is the only agency or kennel club in the world that does not allow coloreds to be judged together with white.
With white, right. They judge them separately.
They judge them separately, yeah.
Interesting.
But they have them all together.
In Europe and in other countries.
Everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere.
Which you see, for example, in the mini bull. Mini bulls have everything all together.
That's because they were brought in after the AKC had given up the idea of varieties. I guess they thought it was too much trouble.
Well, you know, I mean, we have three cockers, we have three dachshunds, we have, my goodness.
With bull terriers, you have dogs coming out of the same litter that can't compete against each other.
Beagles, same thing. Yeah. So, speaking of the American Kennel Club, you are actively involved in the American Kennel Club. Yes, sir.
I was.
Yes.
I spent 20 years on the board. Okay. I retired about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And I spent 5.5, 6 years as chairman and about 8 years as vice chairman. So
yes.
I devoted a lot of time and effort to the American Kennel Club. I don't know of what significance that is anymore.
Well, I think it speaks to the commitment, certainly to the sport. And during your time involved, I think one of the things that I hear today, and I'm sure even during your time when you were on the board, I don't think people really truly understand how the American Kennel Club works for them. Does that make sense?
It's not important. They don't care who gets elected to the board of directors of the American Kennel Club. They're concerned as to when the next show is, who the judge is, and whether or not they can make it.
Right.
And they're concerned about when their bitch is coming in season and who they're going to breed it to. So the guts of the sport is at that level. The governance of it, whether it be in the delegate body or in the board of directors, is of lesser interest to all these people here at the dog show. And if you ask them, name one person on the board of directors, they say, I have the slightest idea. In their breed, they say, well, who's your delegate to the kennel club? And say, I don't know.
This is a very interesting conversation to me, and I'm glad we got to have a chance to talk about this, because I agree with you, and I don't think that that's doing the sport justice. So let's give some ideas for our listeners, because there's a lot of people that listen to this show. So let's give them some ideas. How can they become more aware and more involved and more active in the governance piece?
The governance starts with a delegate body. And a club, whether it be an all-breed club or a parent club, what have you, elects a delegate to the delegate body. Most frequently, that's a person who has probably exhausted their active show and breeding activities. They're older people. So there's a big gap there between the fancy and the delegate body. And then there's a fairly big gap between the delegate body and the board. It's an extraordinary organization to the extent that it's of sufficient size and complexity that it has to be run as if it were a business, but it has to be run as a business that is basically concerned with dogs and dog breeding and dog exhibiting. And sometimes those don't always mesh very well.
It is a very fine line. I know an awful lot of people working at the American Kennel Club, or my delegates and other delegates from other clubs, and I just wonder if, as exhibitors, as just the average, if you will, person on the street at the dog show, and you are a member of your all-breed kennel club or your national parent club, find out who your delegate is. Talk to the delegate. express your concerns to your delegate.
Yeah. How many exhibitors and breeders read the minutes of the delegate meetings or of the board meetings? They don't, of course. And they only become aware of those, that type of the organization, when a new policy or a new regulation,
something affects them directly.
Yeah. I mean, when they develop something like owner handling groups, then they become aware of that, and either they like it or they don't like it. So I'm not sure that you're ever going to get a democratically responsive governance.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, I just always am looking for ways to help bridge some of these gaps that you're talking about and encourage people to know what's out there and that they aren't the boogeyman. They're guys like you that have been doing this for 65 years.
I'm very much a traditionalist, and therefore I have considerable concerns about the direction of the Kennel Club. And it has to do with economics, has to do with registration fees, and those economic concerns. If you look at the income and the registration of the American Kennel Club starting post-World War II in 1946, it was registered probably 250,000 dogs, and it had a budget of in the low millions, $2 or $3 million at most. By 1992, the registration has zoomed up to 1.2 million, and the budget was up to close to 60 million. Then there was the most dramatic drop-off, almost equal to its increase, and it went down to where it is now, which is around 500,000 or so. But the budget has still remained maybe at around $50 million, because once, when it went up high, it was then basically a pet registry. It started out as a show registry with a 250 registered, which is the way most kennel clubs around the world are. They're show registries. They're not pet registries. When it came down, you lost the pet people. And the pet people were paying for the sports people game. So it came down. But as we all know, bureaucracies are easy to build up when there's lots of money. They're very difficult to bring down and also to cut budgets. So then becomes a basic factor in the Kennel Club is that how do we get money aside from registrations? We keep raising the registration fees, but that doesn't quite keep up. So that's gotten the Kennel Club into a lot of these things that I think have diverted their attention from the breeder and the exhibitor.
And that is something that has been noted, and I don't envy the people that have to make those decisions.
If I were king, I would divide the Kennel Club. I would have the traditional part of confirmation and field trials, which is traditionally where the Kennel Club came from, in one group, and then I would have all of the other in another group. And you can have dog diving and disc chasing and everything you want to think of that people enjoy doing with the dogs, and it's fine.
They're like gateway drugs, really, for some of this other stuff.
Well, I'm not sure they would be.
It's going to be interesting to see.
But they needn't be. In the companion activity stuff, if they want to crossbreed or do whatever they want, so be it. Don't give the AKC imprint to that. Call it something else. It won't happen. In essence of that is that each of the two organizations would have to support themselves.
Well, and conceivably better served, or better able to serve, I guess, the markets that they are specifically designed for.
If you have the companion group governing themselves, basically, then they're not at the risk of just being handled offhandedly by the confirmation and the field trial people. Because when you take a field trial regulation in front of the delegates, 90% of them don't know what they're talking about.
I come from German wire-haired pointers. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. But it won't happen.
You know, I think part of the thing that we can do as fanciers, as exhibitors, as people who are, you know, long in the sport, is talk about stuff. We don't have to solve the world's problems, but we can think about it. We can talk about it. Maybe there's ideas out there that nobody's talked about that would be useful. This is kind of a cool idea.
No, but the most important thing is each breed has a coterie of outstanding breeders.
Yes.
They are what move the breed ahead. Nothing AKC dictates, nothing the delegates do, but the people who know how to breed good dogs are committed to breed good dogs, and we've got good dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Not a whole lot of them, because you've got areas of the country where in certain groups and breeds, it's destitute. They're just not there. But if you have good breeders, the sport's going to go on. How we handle the judge situation is entirely another question.
That is another topic of conversation. We've had people on the show and talk about it, and I just, again, it's a long way from when you knew the guy and he said, you look like you've got an eye, here, come judge these dogs.
Yeah, Lynn Brumby sort of was the czar of judge approval. Either you met Lynn Brumby's eye or you didn't. But we've got so many shows now, and we've got so many shows where breed judging is inconsequential. There's interiors, particularly. That's why one reason why I stopped judging is that you go to the average show, and it's now 850 dogs, and there's 65 terriers, and there's 14 or 15 breeds, and it's twos and threes. You're just handing out ribbons, what have you. And that's no fun. But they need to have judges to do that. So that's why we've gotten into this mechanized approval of judges. We spend millions of dollars, the Kennel Club has, in judge approval systems and the mechanism of it. And I think there are three approvals that have to be granted before someone judges my dog. Kennel Club has to initially approve them. The show has to hire the judge. And I have to approve by entering my dog. We place all of the burden on the Kennel Club and none on the hiring club and none on the exhibitor. I mean, people just go to shows because they become traditional shows. And they go in for the thing that's called the lucky dip with the judges. And some breeds like Bull Terriers have turned away from the general all-breed show because the judging is so terrible. They don't know breed type and they're put off by a single fault. And if we've learned anything in Bull Terriers with our great guru Raymond Hoppenheimer is that you don't throw a dog out on one fault. You've got to balance it all with the emphasis on type.
Right. Well, Mr. Merriam, I absolutely have enjoyed this conversation tremendously. I love having challenging and interesting conversations. It makes my day happy, and I know it makes my listeners' day happy.
Okay.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.